Okay, so I would like to say hello and welcome to four of the participants in the documentary Leaving Jesus. I am here with Carrie, Paul, Janice, and Isabel. So hello and welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
We're limited when it comes to equipment, so we're going to do the best we can. But my idea with this episode is to talk a bit about the impressions that you made on me when I watched the documentary. And we're going to... I have a plan. Let's just say that. And let's see how it pans out. So we're going to get into it. I'm going to ask you first, Carrie.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you know what a wine hag is? Did you catch the...
What you just explained.
Yeah, the hag.
Yes.
Yeah. It's good. So
I fit the description.
Yeah. So you can now add to your curriculum vitae.
Ah.
Honorary hag.
Honorary hag.
Honorary wine hag.
I'll put it
that
on.
Is, yeah, I wish I had a pin that I could give you all.
So I'll add it to my LinkedIn.
But it's your former Seventh-day
That's
Adventist.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Born and raised.
Born and raised. And I'm very, very happy to have you here because it's been a sort of a running joke on the podcast that every time there's any sort of craziness, mayhem, there's always a connection to the Seventh-day Adventists.
Yes.
Everything from David Koresh and the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's always Branch...
Yeah, the Branch Davidians.
Branch Davidians with David Koresh, mm-hmm. and the shootout.
Right.
All the way to Dr. Kellogg and his complete, what's the word for it? When you're completely manic.
Fixation.
Fixation on anti-masturbation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know it, Kellogg's cornflakes is actually an invention made by Dr. Kellogg and his brother to prevent people from masturbating, because it was thought that did you know this?
Yeah.
No, it's actually they thought that by consuming meat,
red meat,
you raise your testosterone levels, and with that your virility. So they invented a breakfast alternative that was not meat based to lower the risk of masturbation. This is true. You can look this up.
You can't make this stuff up.
You cannot make this
you can't
stuff
make
up. I could
it
not
up.
Even if I tried.
No.
Yeah.
No.
But we're going to try and work around all of this. But I gave each of you a word or a phrase. That was something that came to me when I watched the documentary and something that I can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And in your story, the expression that I got was to be wrong.
To be wrong.
To be wrong. In the very essence of your being, to be wrong. Would you like to tell me a bit of your thoughts when you heard that phrase?
Well, first of all, I just felt like you nailed it.
Oh, you thank
you. Resonated so exactly with the experience of how I felt. And in fact, I think internally said it to myself that way.
Yeah.
Just that when you are born into the faith and you come to some awareness at some point that you're gay.
Yeah.
Your very body feels like it's betraying you.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of plays in as well with the whole message of any kind of coercive religion,
yeah.
Which is you are wrong. You're evil. Your body is going to betray you. People outside the faith cannot be trusted.
Exactly.
And so there's this, from childhood perspective of, you know, being apart and separate from yourself,
yeah.
And fighting a war against yourself. The whole idea of original sin or having a sinful nature,
yeah.
I think is extremely, extremely abusive to teach to children.
Yeah.
Because essentially what you're teaching them is that they are not good. They don't,
yeah,
belong.
They're flawed.
They're flawed.
Yeah.
They can't be who they are.
Yeah.
And they have to try to behave a certain way in order to get all of the things that they just naturally deserve: love, belonging, care,
yeah,
community. And it gets to a point, I think, of crazy making in your head.
Yeah.
Where you're just feeling like, how can I feel one way and then think another.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a kind of disembodiment and disconnection.
Yeah, and there's an extreme disconnection because you're told one thing that goes completely against what you feel yourself. Because you tell your story in the documentary where you, as a child, knew from a very early age
right.
that not necessarily the whole concept of I'm a gay woman, you don't
I have no yeah. idea what being gay meant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they don't teach it.
No.
Yeah. But there's so many quotes from you that I kept with me from the documentary. Mm. And also, it was really nice. We got to see your wedding as well to your wife,
Miranda.
Oh, my
God, yes.
Yeah. That was lovely. I can relate to the part of being wrong, but for me it was basically the way that I am, my whole personality. Because mm-hmm. we all know there's a few of us women in here, and we all know that there is an expectation mm-hmm. of a specific type of way to be and to conduct yourself.
Right.
You're supposed to be...
A baby maker. Submissive.
Submissive, and you're supposed to be lovely all the time. And mm-hmm. I am...
agreeable.
Exactly, agreeable. And I am nor lovely nor agreeable. So yeah. For me, it was a problem.
It's all hags here.
Yeah, it's all hags here. Yeah. So it's... I think it's an important thing to think about that... That is a problem. How was that for you when you left the church and was finally able to live your life? Because you have to, in a way, now you're married, you get to create your own community, your own family, your own place.
Yes.
But has, for instance, your parents accepted the fact that you're married to a woman yet?
I would say no, that yeah. they have not. I mean, they're very kind.
Yeah.
Up front and in person. My parents, I think, genuinely love me
yeah.
and genuinely love my wife
yeah.
as people. But they fundamentally judge us
yeah.
and who we are. And therefore, there can't really be any real love without acceptance.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that there's just a piece of that that doesn't sit right with either of us. And it makes
yeah.
a... You know, having a genuine relationship with them, having closeness, intimacy, connection, very difficult.
Yeah.
But, you know, just, I don't remember what your original question was, but I'm thinking along the lines of just being wrong.
Yeah.
And how you were saying that you relate with that as well, not just being gay.
Yeah.
But also being a woman.
Yeah.
You know, I felt when I was growing up, like I had leadership skills.
Yeah.
I felt that I had strong opinions. Mm-hmm. I felt that my thinking was clearer than my brother's sometimes.
Yeah.
And on Friday nights, we used to sit down the Sabbath, you know, Friday
yeah,
night
yeah.
sundown to Saturday sundown. We'd sit around and my dad loves to talk politics yeah. and debate. And so I'd sit there with my three brothers and just get dragged over the coals.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I was the only girl that was willing to sit at that table.
Yeah.
And also, I was an easy target because, you know, I was progressive. I was
yeah.
liberal. I felt strongly from childhood that humanism was right,
yeah.
that people deserved respect. And I felt that way because I didn't get any.
And exactly.
So it was clear to me that there was something about what they were doing and teaching and saying that was wrong.
Yeah. And it's also a problem because I can relate to the fact that when you're loved... As long as you're not honest
right.
about your ways of thinking or who you are or your sexuality or what do you call it?
A fundamental rejection.
Yes, it is. And it's also on terms.
Yes.
Terms and agreements apply in a
yeah.
way.
I love you conditionally.
Yeah.
Here are the
exactly
conditions.
Yeah.
You know,
be
straight, get married, have babies, serve in the church, go to church every week.
Yeah.
Don't ever say anything that offends anyone. Don't ever, you know,
yeah.
X, Y, Z. You fill in the blanks. All the Christians out there know.
Exactly.
They can fill those in. But.
Yeah. I'm going to pass the question on to Paul here. Do you have any experience in your time in the church?
Of feeling wrong.
Of feeling like there's just being wrong to the very core of your being.
It's a good question because I would have said no in the past, but as I sit and think about it, the notion of shame is to be fundamentally wrong.
Yeah.
And the only place for the shame to be relieved is through the church.
Yeah.
And the church has instilled the shame from the beginning.
Yeah.
In the Catholic Church, we have this holy water where you go in and when you arrive, you dip your fingers in the holy water and you make the sign of the cross. And the holy water is what cleanses your soul and protects you. And then you get this notion of original sin. And I'm thinking, that's what the holy water was doing.
Yeah.
This is the way that the shame is washed into us every single time. So, yeah, in so many ways, I felt shame and felt wrong.
Yeah.
As a being, something is just wrong with me.
Exactly.
And then, but I'm not gay, so then the notion for a gay person of having, you know, that's another level of horror.
I would say so, because that is a horrible thought, but I remember when I was in the church, that was a thought that would sometimes cross my mind, that thank God at least I'm not gay. It's horrible to say, but it's a memory that comes up now, because the notion I had was that there is something so fundamentally wrong with me. I'm probably loaded with demons. I'm a horrible, broken person. And I remember thinking that thank God that at least I'm not gay, because I don't think that people on the outside can understand the fundamental damnation.
Right.
Because it's not judgment when it comes to gay people in church. It's pure damnation.
Right, and as a gay person, when you realize you can't change that about yourself, there's this sense of horror of hell, just knowing that you cannot fundamentally change this, what you characterize as evil inside of you. And there's nothing you can do about it. You've tried to change. You've tried to get it out of your head. You've tried to stop, you know, having crushes on women, but it's just never worked. And so you have this idea that you're hopeless. And not only that, there's the shame around it, the humiliation of it as well. I think that happens a lot in Christianity, because I think gay people get characterized as perverts.
Yes, of course.
And it's and pedophiles.
Yeah, because it was part of the whole paraphilic. Paraphilic means deviations within sexuality, basically.
Yeah, and that's the way it was characterized by everyone a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that that's all rooted in Christianity and, you know, just social hate of different kinds. But just being a gay person automatically makes you unqualified to belong. And then, you know, struggling with that is a huge secret. So there's isolation, there's hiding. And then it really just adds fuel to the fire of that feeling of, you know, dualism.
Yeah.
Here's who I am on the outside. Here's who I really am on the inside.
Exactly.
And then that terrifying knowledge that, you know, if anyone finds out, you know, I'm done. I mean, I had secret girlfriends all along, and it was absolutely terrifying. Very sexually exciting, but
yes, of course.
Extremely emotionally terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, overall, I think that your part in this documentary will make a huge deal for the LGBTQA community.
I hope
here in Sweden as well.
And can I say something now about being gay? You said, at least I'm not gay. I feel so lucky that at least I'm not gay.
Yes, now I'm jealous.
Gotta love the ladies.
No, it's it's an interesting fact, because you have to also add the fact that the terms and conditions that apply for gay people in the church, that they have this bizarre theology where, of course, you can be gay in our church, but you can't find anybody to love ever. You have to choose to... that. It's the most insane thing. You have to choose a partner of the opposite sex, and then, like, fake a whole life.
Keep denying yourself your whole life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not a life. It's no. just what it takes to belong to that community.
It's insane. And then you have all these pastors with their mistresses and their mistakes and everything. And from their, when it comes to them, it's always, oh, it's an attack from the devil, and it's a mistake, and all leaders can fall, but they expect gay people to just fundamentally not live their mm-hmm. lives.
And I think it's because being gay gives them the ick.
Yeah.
It gives them the ugh, gross.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so it's just very socially still stigmatized.
Yeah.
But I was going to tell you, I feel actually very fortunate that yeah. I am gay.
Yeah.
Because I think if I hadn't been, it wouldn't have motivated me as much to leave the faith, to examine what yeah. was going on inside me, and to really know that fundamentally it wasn't going to be something that worked out for me in the long term.
Yeah.
And I think that as coercive, as controlling, as cult-like as my family was,
yeah.
as my church was, I don't think I would have escaped if I hadn't had to.
No, because if you do fit into the whole thing, it can be a comfortable life. It's an easy
thing. It can be very comfortable.
You know exactly what you expect and
yes.
everything. So, honestly, thank you. Because you say so many things in your part in the documentary that resonated with me. Mostly in the end of the documentary, there is a part where you do this, like a therapeutic scene that is basically a rebirth.
Oh, yes.
And you say that was the kindest and most nurturing thing that has ever happened to me. Thank you.
It's true.
And I bawled my eyes out.
So did I.
Yeah. Because it was beautiful. So thank you.
Yeah, I often describe that experience to my friends. I just am in psychotherapy school right now. Oh. And we all talk about what therapeutic experiences we've had. And I always characterize that one as the burrito experience, where you're
yeah.
wrapped up like a burrito in a sheet. And so when I'm telling people about this, oh, you know, they wrap you up in a sheet and they rock you and all this, people are looking at me like, that's insane.
Exactly.
That doesn't sound like therapy, but I always
that
tell people.
That sounds like kidnapping.
Yeah. It was both the weirdest and the most beautiful therapeutic experience I've ever had, because I really trusted all those people in that room
yeah.
that they saw me, that they saw the way that I needed to be nurtured in that moment. And it was absolutely healing.
Yeah. And they want good things for you.
Yes.
Yeah. And thank you so much for being an honorary wine hag.
It's my pleasure.
Going to move on to you, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
You're a former Catholic.
Former Roman Catholic.
Former Roman Catholic. So that's even a next level with the judgment. But the phrase that you got to contemplate on was the phrase, not my first rodeo.
Yes.
When I told you about this, what was your train of thought? When you heard that,
it's like, oh yeah, that fits.
Yeah, that fits.
and then it relates to all the different gears in my psyche, sitting in the room and thinking, oh, I'm really not suffering from religious trauma. What I'm really suffering from is child sexual abuse and
yeah.
abandonment, and the after effects of alcoholism, and the terrifying problems that come with compulsive sexuality.
Yeah.
And then, oh yeah, where did all that shit start?
Yeah.
In the pews with the shame.
Exactly.
But way before that, it's easy to say, well, it was my parents that did all this to me, because, yes, my father was my first lover. I had a gay affair. I didn't even know what gay was from when I was 13 until when I was 18 with my father, while I was also in high school studying to be a priest.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, having my gay affair on vacation and then going back and being a good seminarian and then confessing, because orgasms feel good. So
yeah.
you can't stop masturbating even if you're in the seminary. And when you said Kellogg and the cornflakes, yeah. I'm going to put an image that nobody will be able to unsee.
Will you?
Yes.
Okay.
Here's the image.
Yeah.
Think of a cornflake.
Yeah.
And imagine a foreskin that has dried up.
Oh, my God. Dear Jesus, God. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and all the saints and all that is holy.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Thank you, Paul. Moving on to Janice.
Do we call that Kellogg?
Yeah.
Why not call them Kellogg's porn flakes? Because he was so obsessed with this thing.
Yeah, and also it's, I think that would be a much more efficient way to get to scare people from masturbating or ever wanting to see or touch a penis again for the rest of their lives. When you see that image in front of you instead. So thank you, Paul.
You're welcome. And now I would also, everything has more than one side.
Yeah.
And this is the part that's makes me shake.
Yeah.
The very same Kellogg we're talking about.
Yeah.
Gave his name and the money he made from his cornflakes to the biological station at Michigan State University, which is where I studied birds.
Okay.
And birds were my escape from all of it.
Really?
From when I was a little boy, when I was 10 years old, in March, going home from school, there were these waxwings in the shrubs, and they were flying around. And I went over because I didn't know what it was, and I saw these things, and I, they're waxwings. And I was hooked.
Yeah, that was your escape.
And from March 12th of 1959 until this very day, yeah. I have been pursuing birds.
Really?
And made it my career. It's like the thing flipped.
Yeah.
Because birds got me out of the house. I was out of range of the violent words and violent talk. And it's very rewarding. And then people started responding positively to me, and then became a career.
Yeah.
And
I also think in a way that birds are often the symbol of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some symbolic in that it's, if I can't be free, I can at least study the thing that is free.
And that's beyond the logic that was going on in my brain. And
yeah, because you were 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a big thing. And birds are, birds really are cool.
Yeah, they are.
They don't give a shit about people, for sure.
Yeah. The thing that I thought about your part in the documentary, Paul, that fascinated me, and the whole thing with the phrase, this is not my first rodeo. What I can sense and what I can hear you say a lot in the documentary are things like, there is nothing that you can say to me that I cannot sit with you through. That you're not scared of other people's lives. You're not scared of trauma. You're not scared of the hard parts. You're willing to sit with people and to take that amount of experience that you have and turn it into something where it's okay for other people to be vulnerable, to show their parts of their lives that are painful. That is really a gift, and also resonates with the rebirth thing that you did, the burrito birth.
Oh, the burrito birth.
Because Marlene says, I think it's Marlene that says it, that you will now be an elder in the true sense of the word. That's what I thought about when I heard your story and the whole thing that we actually have experiences that a lot of people don't have. We have a broader perspective. We've seen some shit. And you can also use that in a good way, in a sense. That was my impression of you, mm-hmm. to make the best with what you have and create an environment that is allowing for other people. So thank you.
Varsågod.
It's good work. I would like to ask you, Janice, as well, what is your experience regarding the phrase "not my first rodeo"? Because you told me beforehand that you also have a podcast, so I'm thinking that this would be something that you're familiar with.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. My podcast is called Divorcing Religion, so yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. And when you talk about not my first rodeo, it does make me think similarly to what you were just talking with Paul about, that when I meet with my clients, because I'm a therapist as well, with religious trauma, I hope that they can sense that from me as well, that it's not
sure
my first rodeo.
Yeah.
They can tell me anything, and we can sit together with it. And it also makes me think of the many, many losses that I suffered when I lost my religious faith. Because that in itself, when that disintegrated, was so disorienting. I was in a free fall. I didn't know what was true and what wasn't true. And then I lost my marriage because I was married to a pastor.
Yeah.
And then also was experimenting with my sexuality because I knew from an early age that I had crushes on boys and girls.
Yeah.
But I wasn't free to do anything about it. So there were just so many things that happened. It's like that was the first card that you pull out of the card house and everything just starts falling. So many things, one after the other. So yeah, when I meet with clients and sit with people, I get it.
Yeah. That's a really good thing, and such an advantage to have, because there is a lack of knowledge within the world of psychiatry. I don't know what it's like we're getting to Norway in a bit, Isabel, but here in Sweden there's a lack of knowledge. And I think in a way that you need to have a part of not my first rodeo in that field, otherwise they can't really understand it.
That's right. Yeah. Lots of people that I hear from say that they have searched far and wide and they haven't been able to find a therapist who is actually familiar with religious trauma syndrome. And so it's quite a relief when they do connect with someone who gets it.
Yeah. We're going to move on to your word, Janice, which is boundaries. Mm-hmm. You said that you were also former Pentecostal, right?
Yes, and Mennonite.
Yeah. And Mennonite, yeah.
Yeah, I used to call myself a Menocostal.
and that would sound like, because both Isabel and myself, we have experiences with the Pentecostal church here in Scandinavia. But to add Mennonites on top of that, you just have to be worse in America all the time. You have to be bigger and it just has to be next level.
right. And you know what? It even falls in kind of with that word boundaries, in as much as to me, what made me feel safe was rules, because I grew up with a very volatile, narcissistic, religious fundamentalist father. And we would get in trouble and be verbally abused and threatened, and he would punch holes in the wall. And so it felt like the only safety was if I could learn the rules and memorize the rules. And so then I was Pentecostal, raised Pentecostal. But then when I learned about Haldeman Mennonites, and they had more rules, I felt even safer. I was like, oh, there are more rules that I can live by.
Because I do think that there is something to be said about people that are highly anxious. If you deal with a lot of anxiety, the whole thing with all the rules of the church at first can be a positive.
Mm-hmm.
That you have such clear frames.
I didn't have to think.
Yeah, you don't have to think, because there is a rule for everything. This is how long you can have your hair. Mm-hmm. This is if your skirt is above the knee, you're basically the whore of Babylon.
Oh, yeah,
or
Jezebel.
Anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have rules to adjust to. Mm-hmm. And that can also be a very, very safe place mm-hmm. for a person that's highly anxious, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Because I felt, I always felt vulnerable and exposed with my father, never yeah. knowing what he was going to be like or what was going to happen. So being able to just stay within the rules all the time and have top grades and be top at whatever I was trying to do in school, then that would bring me some safety rather than being picked on, I think, by yeah. him. Mm-hmm.
Your part in the documentary isn't as clear. You're always there,
yeah.
but it's not as clear. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you say one thing about boundaries mm-hmm. when you have some sort of arts mm-hmm. and crafts thing in therapy.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking, because I think that there is a duality to the problem when you leave the faith.
Oh, yeah.
In a way, you have to break down mm-hmm. Boundaries that has been put up for you by the church and the elders and leaders.
Right.
Regarding other people, the dangers of things that are redeemed sinful mm-hmm. when it's just, like in your case, a lovely woman that you married. but it's still a boundary to break down. And at the same time, you have to rebuild the normal boundaries.
Yes. And so another aspect of that maybe is the codependency that's baked right into Christianity. Yeah. My mom, whom I love very much, but very tends towards codependency. So yeah. the need to be needed, to always be serving, because that's yeah. what the church says, especially for females. You must always be serving others. You
exactly.
know, J-O-Y, Jesus, others, yourself. Yourself is
exactly.
last
yeah.
there. So I didn't really feel like I had boundaries in that sense, because I couldn't say no to anyone.
No.
And I went on to suffer horribly in relationships that way, because I didn't know that I could say no, and people took advantage of me, because I also was quite innocent in that
yeah.
way. And so painful, a lot of painful lessons from not knowing my boundaries. And I still work on boundaries. I'm married to Paul, and Paul often says that I have good boundaries. And I'm just like, well, yeah. no, there's still work
I'm
to be done. That's right.
He's allowing you the place to grow, but
yeah.
that's a good thing. That's beautiful, actually. I didn't know that you guys were married.
Yes. We met through Dr. Winnell. We met
really?
In her online support group,
oh,
and
nice.
Then we met in person at a couple of the retreats there, and then it was just a wonderful thing.
Oh, that's lovely. Congratulations.
Thank you.
One thing that I thought about, because in the church, the thing that they have to do to control you, in a way, is break you down. And part of that is breaking down your boundaries. And we talked about this earlier when we had coffee, that it can sometimes feel like it's training a dog.
Oh, yeah.
So they break you down to the point where they don't even need to have a leash around your neck, because the leash is in your head.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I have a severe problem with this, because you always notice that you're supposed to be available at all times. You're supposed to do this and that at the expense of yourself. And mm-hmm. I can only remember one thing, because I can be social, but I hermitate a lot. I'm just, oh, the silence. It's just me. It's my happy place.
Yeah.
It's just to go somewhere and just be alone.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not allowed.
Yeah.
In the church,
that's
I remember
right.
you were supposed to, as a woman, you were supposed to want to have an open home. And I think we can talk about that, because the whole there's not a clearer image of boundaries than mm-hmm. a door.
Right.
So your door is supposed to be open mm-hmm. and people are supposed to come and go. And that is my fucking nightmare.
Yes, yes.
There's nothing worse. And also Swedish. We're awkward by blood. You know this, Isabel. You're Norwegian. It's basically the same thing. But there's nothing more terrifying for a Swedish person than a spontaneous knock on the door. What the fuck is happening? Is it the police? But where is the fire? It's just something that is so, in that sense, I'm culturally normal. Yes. But I also think that in the church we're supposed to have all these, you know, open homes, and your time was to be used for mm-hmm. for the good of everybody else, and you never had any time. And for basically all Swedish people and people that are need alone time to recharge, this is a nightmare.
Yes.
And it's hard to learn to, when you leave the church, it's hard to learn to say no for the benefit of yourself.
Yes, yes. And Paul and I actually were just talking about this the other day. And I said, I think the ABCs of religious trauma are authority, belief, and control.
Yeah.
And then the ABCs of religious trauma recovery is autonomy and bravery and curiosity.
Yeah.
Because we need to step into our own autonomy. We have to give ourselves permission to be curious and then be brave enough to step through the doors that we choose to open. Exactly. But it doesn't happen overnight. It's a process of getting there.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to pass the mic to Isabel, because I would like to hear what is your experience with boundaries, both within the church and after leaving. How has that been for you?
Just boundaries in general?
Yeah. Or do you need me to be more specific?
Yes, please.
You know, the church will say that maybe you don't have the energy to do this, but you need to, because mm-hmm. it's for the Lord.
Yeah.
That is one of the ways for breaking down boundaries. It's also okay if you haven't thought about this as much.
No, I've struggled with boundaries in many ways.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if I can relate it to church just right now, but with my life and other areas, like in relationships, in regards to sex, in regards to friendships and having to say no, you know, I can relate to that, absolutely.
Are you aware of the fact that it's a very, very common problem for people that have left the church?
Yeah, I've never thought about it that way, but there might be a link there, yeah.
It might be a
probably.
Teeny tiny thing there.
Probably,
yeah. But I think we're going to thank you, Janice, for your thoughts on the matter. And I think we're going to move on to your word, Isabel. Yeah. Your former Pentecostal.
Yeah.
From the Bible Belt in Norway.
Yes. Southwest of Norway.
Yeah. It's close to Kristiansand.
Yeah, it's between Kristiansand and Stavanger.
Yeah. When I watched the documentary, the impression and the word that came to me regarding your story was fear.
Yes.
And this is a hard one to talk about. Mm-hmm. Because I went to, for instance, Pentecostal Bible school, and the old indoctrination with there's demons not only in you, your friends, everything, there's demons in stuff, or anything.
Teletubbies. And
everything was
Pokemon,
demonic.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your... what were your thoughts when I gave you that word, fear? What
do you think just, about that? It was just, yes. Absolutely, fear. Fear was a big part of my life for the first 30 years of my life, yeah. So...
I get why
that was the word that came to your mind.
But I was thinking about earlier, because last year I did two episodes regarding rapture anxiety.
Oh. Don't get me started.
Yeah, so you're part of the fun gang that has like crippling fear with rapture.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get the same thing where you can just leave your house in the morning and if it's quiet... nobody's out, you go, oh fuck, I missed it, it's happened, rapture's here, and I'm the only one left.
Not anymore, baby. But yes, for years.
Yeah, but that is a hard one.
Yeah, yes,
awful. Whoever got the idea for the movie Left Behind? It ruined years of my life and nights and trying to sleep. And
no, this person should be in prison.
Just for, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. You know,
spreading mass chaos. Spreading mass chaos. Yeah.
I was terrified. I remember one morning, I think I was probably 6 or 7. I went upstairs because usually I would listen to sounds coming from the house if anyone was awake. Yeah. I was terrified of being alone all the time. I had huge separation anxieties and that feeling of having to check, is someone here or is it quiet? Because then the rapture would have happened. It was tight to anything or everything in my life for years. Yeah. And I remember that morning I got upstairs and I saw my father's clothes lying like the scene from the movie. You know the scene in the movie where on the airplane and in the big trailer car thing.
Yeah.
And it was like they had clothes on, but then they had just left their clothes. Yeah. So their clothes were like folded, like as if someone was still in there. Or, yeah. You all know
it's
what
a
I mean,
weird
right?
Pile.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember one morning I had just woken up and I had just gotten a room downstairs in the basement because I was so scared of sleeping alone. So that was completely new to me and I felt really proud about that. And then one morning I went upstairs and I saw my father's clothes lying like that. And I was terrified. And I had to go out into the neighborhood and see, you know, is anyone here? Look for people. And I looked for, you know, anyone. And then I saw an old lady that lived close to my house, but then I didn't know if she was a Christian or not. So I didn't know, had the rapture happened, maybe not, because she is, you know, this
are
old
you
hag.
Condemned to hell, maybe?
Yes, so that wasn't good enough. And then I remember seeing a child.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh, a child, okay, I'm safe. Because children are taken up, right? But I was a child, and I didn't realize that, you know, I could look at myself.
Yeah.
But no, that didn't even occur to me.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. So stuff like that. Yeah. The rapture was huge. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think so many people struggled with that and probably still do.
I think so. And also the whole weird thing of placing the thought in people's head that everybody is demonic in a sense.
Yeah.
It makes you lose, in a way, touch with reality of some sort, because your head is so up in the clouds in this spiritual world.
Yeah, and you can't really deal with it. You can't do anything about it because, you know, many people are afraid of robbery or, you know, people coming into your house or predators in some way. But if you're scared of something that can go through the wall, what are you supposed to do with that? You know, you can't escape ever. And you don't know. Yeah. And you know, for the Pentecostal church, Pentecost is a big thing, right?
Yeah.
So the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost is really important, and talking to, you know, Spirit or the Holy Spirit and having to seek out that voice inside you. And that was also a struggle. Which voice is it? You know, is it that voice? Or is it that voice? And how do you find it? And is it really that voice? Or is it my, you know, all those thoughts. And then if you think that maybe you might be possessed by demons or something, you know, which voice is that?
Exactly.
You know? So it's...
How are you supposed to differentiate?
Confusing. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to pass the microphone to Carrie real quick. What is your experience with fear within the faith?
For me, fear and shame kind of went hand in hand.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you got the word fear, I was thinking that could have easily been mine as well. Just because I think that, you know, it's the fear of loss. And the loss is either hell, it's your family, it's yourself, you know, but you're losing something. And will I be able to survive that? Will I be okay? And you really don't know as a child. You don't think you're going to be okay. And so fear really, I think, gripped me most of my life and took hold of all my actions and formed everything I did. It was put others first because I don't want to be selfish.
Yeah.
It was deny my sexuality because I don't want to be rejected. I don't want to go to hell. You know, so it's all of the motivations were not based in who am I in the world and what do I want to do? What do I want to contribute? Who do I want to love? It was all, how do I avoid sinning?
Yeah.
How do I avoid this huge pitfall that I've been told about, this huge, exactly. scary thing that I should be absolutely terrified? And I relate with what you were saying about the demons as well. I was afraid of demons well into college.
Yeah.
And I was at an Adventist university. I was probably a freshman or a sophomore in college. The last time I remember being really physically afraid of demons. And I had a girlfriend at the time. And so, of course, I thought, you know, whew, if they're not in me, they're coming for me.
Yeah.
And this girlfriend I had, she wanted to watch a demon movie. And
oh,
so,
dear Lord.
Yes. We watched some. It was The Exorcist. It was The Exorcist, right. And
it's like boot camp first.
it was boot camp. Yeah, I didn't know what to expect, but that movie just absolutely impacted me with so much fear that I knew on some level was unnatural. I was like, this is a made up movie about, you know, all this kind of stuff, but you know, demons, that's a real thing. And I remember going to bed that night, my roommate having the lights off and just rushing up to my bed, and it was the top bunk, and I just remember running up there and thinking, good God, Carrie, you're 19 years old. You shouldn't be running into bed in the dark, but that's how they brainwash you to be. So fear for me has been a huge part of my life.
Yeah.
But then conversely, it's also made bravery a huge part of my life.
One can't exist without the other. You
right.
can't be brave if you're not afraid. It's
well, and it's also just the things to be afraid of are the realities that could actually hurt you.
Yeah.
When somebody makes up a story to make you afraid, it just puts you in a state of terror that's not helping you at all.
Yeah.
And that's the abuse of it. You know, there's fear that's useful, right? I fear going close to that cliff because I might fall off.
Yeah.
It's very useful for us to have that. That's who we are adaptively as humans. And the way that religions use this is very coercive and controlling.
Yeah.
We're going to implant these fears in your head.
Exactly.
Like we said. So you'll self-police. Do what we say, live how we want, give us your money, give us your time, give us your behavior, and then you can belong. Then you can have this really beautiful, loving, happy life with all these other Christians who are so wonderful and everyone else is shit.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's just a fucked up tale.
Yeah. It's a fucked up tale, and that is a good way. I think we're going to have to wrap this up. I would like to first thank all of you for coming. I'm incredibly grateful. Isabel, Janice, Paul, Carrie, it's been a pleasure meeting you. And I would like to leave you with one thing. It's a poem by, I think it's an American poet called Walt Whitman. He wrote a book called Leaves of Grass, which is my favorite book of poetry of basically all time. And there is a poem in that one that I would like you to look up, because that thing, I found that in my teenage years. And I actually, to this day, believe that that some sort of way kept me above water throughout my years before I left. And there's two parts in the poem that made me think of you guys that I find lovely. And it's called To You. And it basically, it's an ode to man, male or female. But it's a beautiful way of speaking about the core essence of a person. Because it talks about, you know, behind all this, the aesthetics, the busy life, the everything that we add on to ourselves. And then there's a sentence that I love that is, behind all of that, I see you lurk. Mm-hmm. And that is the most beautiful way to describe a human being, that there's something behind all the shit. There you are. Look at you go. Mm. And I think it's the end of the poem is, what you are picks its way. And it gives me goosebumps every time, because it's, whatever it is, it will become better, and what you are picks its way. It will find It's way out into the light and everything. And what we do with our time in between, it's we do what we can with what we have. And thank you all for doing what you can, participating in this documentary. It means so much to the rest of us. So thank you. Thank you so much. So I have to just do the thank you to all the listeners. Tack till alla som lyssnar. Tack till alla Patreons. Och ha det gott. Hej. Through your